Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The strike group of the USS Nimitz aircraft carrier conducted military exercises off the Korean Peninsula this week. This follows 11 days of the largest land-based drills involving South Korea and the U.S. in almost 5 years. The U.S. has increased joint drills with South Korea in the past year, particularly those involving nuclear-capable weapons, so-called strategic assets.
The United States has deployable strategic assets at the ready on every day. And we can continue to deploy those assets, and we will. Again, we really want to underpin the international security and the global commons so we can all prosper. And I think that's our message.
North Korea protested the drills test-firing ballistic and cruise missiles as Pyongyang views such exercises as a rehearsal for invasion. The Nimitz drills were followed up with a massive joint U.S.-South Korea amphibious landing exercise Wednesday. Activists argue such drills carry risks.
The more South Korea-U.S. military exercises are conducted, the larger the scale, the stronger the North is protesting and testing more missiles. If the South Korea-U.S. military exercises expand, the confrontation will intensify, and I think increase this vicious cycle of confrontation.
For President Yoon Suk-yeol, the drills show how he's succeeded in strengthening the U.S.-South Korea alliance. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol earlier this month re-emphasized his hardline position with North Korea, saying that Pyongyang would pay a price for its recent missile launches, what he calls provocations. President Yoon also said North Korea would not receive a penny in aid from the South as long as it continued its nuclear weapons development. The confrontation on the Korean Peninsula may heat up further with even larger exercises planned to celebrate the 70th anniversary of the U.S.-South Korea alliance in June. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A massive march has been held along the fence separating the Gaza Strip from the occupied territories to commemorate the 47th anniversary of the Land Day. People from all walks of life took to the streets of the besieged Gaza Strip to stress their right to return to their land.
We are here today to commemorate the Land Day to stress on our Palestinian identity and our entitlement to the land. We say to the Israeli occupation, you have no place in Palestine. Leave it so the world can eventually enjoy peace and freedom.
Land Day marks the events of March the 30th, 1976, where six Palestinians were killed by Israeli forces during peaceful protests against the Tel Aviv regime's decision to seize tracts of Palestinian-owned lands. Palestinians call on the international community and the Arab countries to support the Palestinian people in their quest for liberation.
We are addressing all the international community, the Arabs, the Muslims in the world, to stand up, to stand up with us, to support also our resistance to return to my home. We are refugees. We are going to return sooner or later.
The National and Islamic Action factions emphasized the unity of the Palestinian people. They also reaffirmed the Palestinians' right to resist, stressing that resistance is the sole way to restore the stolen Palestinian land.
Today we assert on the Palestinians' adherence to their lands and to the Al-Quds, the eternal capital of Palestine, and we affirm on the resistance as the most appropriate choice to free Palestine.
The Thursday peaceful demonstration turned violent when the Israeli forces shot and injured a Palestinian with live ammunition. Two others were injured when they were hit by tear gas canisters used by the regime's troops to disperse the protesters. This reminds us of what happened in the Great March of Return rallies, which began in 2018 and lasted for 86 weeks. During the protests, more than 300 Palestinians were killed, by the Israeli troops, and thousands more sustained injuries, including so serious wounds that led to the loss of limbs.
I was wounded with Israeli live ammunition in the Great March of Return, and today, despite my injury in my leg that might get amputated, I am here today to commemorate the Land Day, stress on our steadfastness despite the Israeli atrocities.
The Israeli regime seizes the Palestinian own land and demolishes Palestinians' homes in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds in order to construct new illegal settlements.
These annual demonstrations serve as an act of collective resistance to the Israeli occupation as Palestinian demonstrators voice their anger at the regime's crimes and land grab policies and reiterate their entitlement and right of return to their own land, Al-Asif, Gaza.
Russia and Iran are in the final stage of finalizing a draft agreement on comprehensive partnership between the countries.
I am very grateful that the draft of comprehensive agreement on strategic partnership between our countries has been reviewed and finalized in Russia. We are now reviewing it again as well. I very much hope that within the next month, the legal departments of the foreign ministries of our two countries will finalize this draft.
The document is of strategic importance of solid, balanced new realities of bilateral cooperation between Moscow and Tehran. The treaty outlines the main guidelines for further building of the entire complex of Russian-Iranian relations for the coming decades. Among them is that Iran and Russia both agree that the JCPOA has no alternatives and needs to be implemented as soon as possible.
We talked about the situation around the JCPOA on the Iranian nuclear program. We have a common understanding that there is no alternative to this international agreement, which was written down in the unanimously adopted UN Security Council Resolution 2231. We are in favor of the early resumption of the full implementation of this resolution and oppose actions that prevent this.
Lavrov said that the U.S. needs to lift sanctions against Iran and return to its obligations under JCPOA. The minister added that the West also seeks to neutralize China along with Russia.
Therefore, Russia, Iran, China, and many other countries will categorically oppose attempts to establish Western hegemony forever and ever, as Washington and its henchmen are trying to do.
Lavrov noted that Russia respects Iran's interests in a peaceful settlement of the Ukrainian conflict. Amir Abdullahian, for his part, pointed out that Western supplies of various weapons to Kyiv complicate the Ukraine conflict, which he said should only be settled via political means. Meanwhile, Russian-Iranian cooperation in the military technical sphere is carried out in accordance with Russia's international obligations. The parties have found an approach in all areas when it is possible to concentrate on coinciding interests and systematically build up economic cooperation as well.
Russia has become the largest investor in Iran over the past fiscal year. Russia accounted for 2/3 of the total foreign direct investments in the Islamic Republic. The volume of Moscow's investments in Iran has reached $2.76 billion. Marina Kartonova, Moscow.
The margins were slim, the result momentous. Hamza Yousaf, a Muslim of Pakistani and Kenyan descent, becoming leader of the Scottish National Party after a bruising leadership campaign.
It is hard for me to find the words to describe just how honoured I am to be entrusted by our membership of the SNP to be the party's next leader and to be on the cusp of being our country's next First Minister.
The party he leads has a slim majority in the Scottish Parliament and has been working in coalition with the Progressive Green Party, for whom Yousaf, who has pledged continuity with his liberal predecessor Nicola Sturgeon's era, is perhaps the right successor, compared to Economy Minister Kate Forbes, whose campaign got off to a rocky start over her socially conservative views.
I think there'd be a sigh of relief because I think if Kate Forbes, who got a far higher vote than was expected, but if Kate Forbes had won, then the Greens had said they were not going to serve under her. So there's a sigh of relief that the coalition will continue.
The new First Minister faces major challenges, though. Record high National Health Service waiting times under him as Health Minister. Nicola Sturgeon's education promises yet to be fulfilled. and the UK government's blocking of a cross-party act of the Scottish Parliament on gender self-ID, which exposed deep divisions within the SNP, plus the issue of Scottish independence.
As First Minister, Hamza Yousaf has promised to lead for all in a country of 5.5 million. Yet despite the country being stuck around 50-50 on the question of independence from the UK and of Westminster, he has pledged to make it happen.
The last unsuccessful independence referendum was held in 2014, and the most recent attempt at holding a second one without the consent of Westminster was struck down by the UK's Supreme Court.
A lot of independent supporters, not just SNP members, feel frustrated. There have been constant promises, yes, there'll be a referendum, constant promises of a big campaign which never materialised. People are becoming frustrated, and I think Hamza, as First Minister, is going to have to address that.
Outgoing First Minister Nicola Sturgeon tendered her resignation to the UK King on Tuesday. It remains to be seen if her successor will make her the last one. Saeed Bourza, London.
A vigil has been held in Gaza to condemn the spike in Israeli violations of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the West Bank. Over the past few days, and with the beginning of the holy month of Ramadan, dozens of Israeli forces stormed the vicinity of the compound of Al-Aqsa Mosque. They assaulted and blockaded Muslim worshippers and forced them out of the holy site, paving the way for Israeli far-right extremists to enter the mosque. That prompted Palestinians and resistance factions to reiterate their readiness to defend Al-Aqsa and repeat the 2021 Operation Sword Al-Quds if the Al-Aqsa status quo is violated.
The Palestinian used to just look at the situation in the West Bank and Al-Aqsa Mosque. These violations crossed the red line and the Palestinian people began to lose their patience. The Palestinian resistance has something to say if the occupation regime crosses our red line.
Palestinians and Muslims reject the temporal and spatial division of the Al-Aqsa Mosque between Muslims and Jews. This is while Israel keeps violating the internationally agreed status quo of the mosque. Ramadan every year witnesses Israeli attacks against Palestinians gathered in the holy place. In 2021, the expulsion of Palestinian families from their homes in Al-Quds and the Israeli raids on Al-Aqsa Mosque during the holy month of Ramadan led to an 11-day aggression on Gaza. More than 260 Palestinians were killed during the assault, including 67 children and 41 women. Over 2,000 Palestinians were injured and many more internally displaced.
Our message to the Israeli occupation is that breaching the sanctity of Al-Aqsa Mosque puts Israel on the verge of a collapse. Because our people will never remain silent over these violations, nor will they accept the temporal division of Al-Aqsa.
A surge in Israeli settler violence and military raids on Palestinian towns have claimed the lives of more than 90 Palestinians since the start of this year. That makes 2023 the deadliest year in decades in the occupied East Al-Quds and the West Bank.
We in Gaza are telling you that you can count on us. We support you in each and every step of operation you take against the Israeli occupation regime. We salute your struggle and reiterate our steadfastness toward our land. We will never leave our land.
There are concerns that tensions in the occupied territories would escalate as Israeli forces and settlers continue their attacks on Palestinians and violate their sanctities in clear defiance of calls to stop the violence.
The repeated Israeli attacks against the Palestinians in the West Bank and the regime's flagrant violations of the Holy Al-Aqsa Mosque during the fasting month of Ramadan have been met with strong condemnations here in Gaza, where people express their unwavering support for Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque.
The United Nations headquarters in Geneva once again played host to the annual Human Rights Council session on Monday, where the UN Special Rapporteur to Iran released a report on women's rights situation inside the Islamic Republic. Predictably, his views sparked major disputes with Iran's delegation over accusations of mistreatment of women in recent months following Western-backed anti-Iran riots.
Advocacy for human rights is increasingly mistaken by some states and human rights mandate holders. for their unwarranted and egotistic purposes, abusing the human rights mechanisms to single out and target those nations with independent foreign policy is void of any added value for protection of human rights.
As the envoys battled it out, two Iranian onlookers had a very real story of abuse, which had been largely ignored until now. Manager Safiyari and Elham Jalizavi, two Iranian nationals who suffered horrifically following terrorist attacks on Iranian soil. The culprits, notorious anti-Iran terrorist group the MKO, an obscure cult organization which currently receives significant Western support and even maintains a presence at the UN itself via NGOs.
By providing them asylum, Western countries violated the 1951 convention, enabling them to carry on all their human rights violations, which has, in turn, led to our rights being violated.
Safiyari was left wheelchair-bound at 17 after an MKO bomb attack targeted a market in 1985. Jalizavi was just 15 when her father was killed in their home by an MKO mortar attack in 1991. These are just two examples of the countless Iranian victims of MKO aggression. With the help of a sympathetic non-governmental organization, the Association for Defending Victims of Terrorism, their calls for justice have now reached the heart of the UN.
The MKO are a cult who commit these acts. Their members have been duped into cooperating with them. They've also been brainwashed. Their families, too, have suffered as a result. They, too, have fallen victim to the MKO.
They should be tried in court, not allowed to come here and claim innocence. We have even filed a lawsuit with French courts because many members live in France, but unfortunately the courts voted in their favour.
Despite past recognition of the MKO as terrorist organisation in the Western world, the US and its allies have performed a U-turn, now promoting them as legitimate opposition to the Islamic Republic, despite their many crimes against Iranian civilians.
The relationship between the Islamic Republic and the United Nations have gone through strained times, but it seems as if the UN is seemingly happy to continue providing a platform for anti-Iran terrorist organizations such as this. And as long as they do, it'll be hard to believe that ordinary Iranians will ever be able to fully trust this international institution. Robert Carter, Geneva.
Quranic verses and anti-Israeli and U.S. slogans rank high in this year's National Day of Resilience demonstration in the capital Sana'a, where protesters celebrated what they called 9 years of successful resistance against the Saudi-led war, which began back in March 26, 2015. Yemen's Supreme Political Council leader, Mohammed Ali al-Houthi, who was present at the demonstration, said the armed resistance against all enemies of Yemen will continue until every inch of Yemeni land is liberated from foreign presence.
We must protect our resistance effort and continue to counter this enemy. We must march forward together and confront this enemy. We must focus more on the battlefront and prepare for it now more than ever before. We must support our Ministry of Defense, which is equipped with men who have the hearts of lions, men who will teach the enemy a lesson they will never forget.
When Saudi Arabia launched its war back in 2015, it said it would destroy all heavy weapons possessed by Ansar Allah and force them to withdraw from the Yemeni capital. What has happened, however, is quite the opposite. The Ansar Allah movement has managed to win the battle across the board, developing sophisticated weapons and taking over more territory. They've also managed to win the hearts and minds of the majority of the people in the north.
We have been at war for 9 years, and we will continue to go to war for another 90 years if we must. We will never surrender, no matter how much they bomb. Our faith is in Allah, and it will never be shaken.
We came out in this huge protest to send a message to the Saudi-led coalition that we will remain resilient and we will never betray our cause, even if they add another 9 years to the previous 9 years of war. With our military of believers in Allah, we are coming for you. We are coming with our ballistic missile.
According to Mohammed Ali al-Houthi, if the Saudi-led coalition continues its war on Yemen, they will only witness greater losses and a bigger humiliation.
The war that was only supposed to last a few weeks
has entered its ninth year. What's even more surprising is that the Yemeni army is stronger now than ever before. That's because they have developed long-range ballistic missiles and drones, which could be used if the war continues. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be looking at a very interesting question. That question is about the virtues of fasting. What are the virtues of fasting? As you know, we are in the month of Ramadan. The month of Ramadan is a very blessed month, is a very sacred month. It's the month in which the Holy Quran was revealed, and it is also the month in which we are obliged to fast. This is the month of Ramadan, which we are obliged to fast. And, you know, knowing about the virtues of, you know, anything that we do, its benefits, its virtues, why it's good, what are its effects, all of these have a great, effect on and motivate us to get out there and do, the act of worship that we are learning about. Fortunately, we have an answer to this question in the various hadiths, which have been related from our infallibles regarding the virtues of fasting. In a blessed tradition, in a prophetic tradition, the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa sallam has been reported to have said, everything has a zakat. Everything, لِكُلِّ شَيْءٍ زَكَاتٌ وَزَكَاتُ الْأَبْدَانِ. And the zakat of the bodies is to fast, right? So there was the bodies, you know, the body that we're given, this is a blessing from Allah that He has given us. And, like every blessing has a zakat. For example, we have a hadith that says that the zakat of knowledge is to teach, right? You know, and so the zakat of good health, the body that we've been given, is to fast. But this is not like, just like charity, the charity that we give, we get a twofold reward for us, meaning our wealth, it increases by means of it. This is one of those things that, it's kind of hard to comprehend with our limited intellects. You know, our intellects tell us that if you give something away, you know, it doesn't lead to the increase of wealth, it leads to its decreasement. But no, here, religion tells us, no, the more you give, the more your wealth will increase. Similarly, if we fast, it helps us, and our health becomes better. This is why the Prophet said, fast and you will be healthy. Sumu tasehu. These are some of the physical blessings of fasting, spiritual effects of fasting. But we also have other spiritual effects of fasting. For example, the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, the fasting person is in constant worship of Allah, even when he is sleeping in his bed, as long as he does not backbite a fellow Muslim. And he also said, this is a famous prophetic hadith, As-sawmu Junnatum min an-nar, fasting acts as a shield from the fire of hell. It protects us from the fire of hell. And finally, the daughter of the Prophet, Fatimah al-Zahra, salamullah alayha, she has been reported to have said, Allah made fasting obligatory in order to reinforce sincere devotion to Him. Faradallahu as-siyama tathbitan lil-ikhlas. Meaning the more we fast, if we fast, you know, our sincerity to Allah, it increases. And sincerity, this is one of these very central and important virtues within Islam, which the acquisition of which was always the aspirant and the always the desire of the prophets and the righteous people. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the virtues of fasting. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to Israel, it is finding itself in uncharted waters. Israelis have revolted against the Prime Minister Netanyahu and its administration, which many have called fascists. The so-called judicial reforms were called off for now, with the U.S. President telling PM Netanyahu to call it off altogether. But when it comes to Palestinians, Israeli atrocities have continued unabated, and maybe even worse. Palestinian deaths have hit a record this year at around 90, and now Israel has unveiled a plan to form a, quote, settler militia by the name of the National Guard, further endangering Palestinian lives. Those topics and more in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce our guests. Zakir Ahmed Mayet, who's an attorney, activist, and political analyst, joins us from Johannesburg. Also joining us, Masin Ghobsaya, who's a Palestinian scientist and author, who joins us from Bethlehem.
Is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Zakir Ahmed Mayet, first over to you. So we're looking at what the U.S. President has said. I'm sure you've heard that soundbite maybe multiple times at this point, where there was an icy exchange, and you have the U.S. President Joe Biden saying that Israel cannot continue with its controversial legal overhaul. And, of course, Netanyahu responding, saying that he will not be pressured by foreign governments, including from the best of friends. What do you think about that exchange?
The position of the Israeli state is truly precarious. We've never seen a complete collapse and isolation of the Israeli state, both internally and externally. Even their own ally, the United States, has placed a frown upon their heads, stating that the reforms or proposed reforms are completely off the cliff. However, I'm not particularly disturbed by these statements. We saw a similar cold relationship that took place between the United States and Israel during the Obama administration, particularly when we saw the conflict spilling out into the open between Netanyahu and Obama with regards to the JCPOA and the Iranian nuclear deal. So I'm not particularly surprised when I see the separation. I think it is the moment of truth when the arms stop flowing towards Israel from the United States and the financial support stops. At this particular point in time, all we have are cold statements, and we still see that they continue to support the Zionist state. The bigger field of focus should be the internal affairs of Israel and where it stands at the moment. In fact, most of the analysts are indicating, and these are Israeli analysts, that Israel is about to tear itself apart. And I think that bodes well for the Palestinians long term. However, we will discuss this, I'm sure, further on in the program as to the atrocities that are being heaped upon the Palestinians in the chaos that is transferring itself both from Israel into the occupied Palestinian territories and settler violence as we see it happening almost on a daily basis now.
Sure, we're going to be covering that for sure. Mr. Kopsaya, I'm going to address the same question to you. This is what the U.S. president said. Like many strong supporters of Israel, I'm very concerned, and I'm concerned that they get this straight. They cannot continue down this road, and I've sort of made that clear. As our guest there said, there have been fissures between Israel and the U.S. on a number of occasions, particularly with Obama being one of them. Do you think this one is different, though, at this time?
I really think that the Israeli state is first in crisis, but the crisis is between two sides of Zionism. One side that's a religious fundamentalist up-in-your-face side, and the other one is the so-called more moderate Zionism. Both, of course, call for ethnic cleansing and have engaged in ethnic cleansing. But this is not unusual. In fact, 100 years ago, between Jabotinsky camp and Ben-Gurion camp, there was a dispute, and it reached a point where in 1948, they actually attacked the ship carrying arms for one of the factions. So I don't think there is any particularly unique aspect of this division. It's just that the Israeli society is built on internal contradictions as well as on suppression of the Palestinians. And the growth of the religious Zionist faction that we see was predicted by many people, from Edward Said to Hisham Sharabati and many, many others, you know, who argued that this is inevitable, that will happen, that fascism will rise in Israel because the right-wing religious fanatics reproduce fast, and the secular Zionist racists are not as reproductively effective.
Zaki Ahmed Mayed, you know, Israel has violated Palestinian rights for quite some time. That's common knowledge. But isn't this time different? I mean, let's talk about who's in power here. You're talking about this guy by the name of Smotrich, who talked about how Hawara should be wiped out, that his words were Hawara needs to be wiped out, basically, which he then retracted as a slip of the tongue. Now, we're going to go down the list of some of the things that he has said. But you're looking at him, you're looking at Itamar Ben-Gvir, who has called for the execution of Palestinians if they work against Israel, who has said that the Palestinian flag is illegal to be raised, or to be, raised in public. We're talking about, you know, what many have called fascist members of this cabinet. I mean, this type of combination hasn't been in place to this degree, has it? And we're seeing some of the actions that they're partaking in.
Yes, the combination of Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich. We haven't seen this combination before. By every standard of analysis, this is the most right-wing government we've ever witnessed. But just before I touch on this particular point, it's something that the fellow panelist said now about the ship that was attacked, the fight between the Stern and the Irgun. It was actually Yitzhak Rabin who was the head of that operation. He joined the Special Forces Division at the age of 14. It's a common argument used by the Zionists to say that young people are rising up from amongst the Palestinians and that's terrorism, encouraging children to fight. But Rabin himself at the age of 14 was involved in this operation. However, coming back to this particular point and more onto the topic, the combination of Bezalel Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir has only exposed the true face of Israel. It's so extreme, and we must understand this time frame just before the elections that it was the right-wing government that was voted in, because at the time they wanted to teach the Palestinians a lesson as a result of what happened in Sefer Quds and the internal uprising within Israel proper. Now you have the same elements that put these individuals in place stating that this is too far, this is too extreme. This is exactly what Israeli society is. It's an apartheid society. It is one predicated on Jewish supremacy, as is stated in the Beth Salem report. And this is unacceptable. When you look at Itamar Ben-Gvir, for example, he had a poster of Barak Goldstein, who committed the Ibrahimi massacre in 1994, mowing down worshippers whilst they prayed. This is the leadership that venerates this type of terrorism. So when we look at what's happening within Israel, what is actually happening is that the true face of Israel is being exposed by their leadership. And the comments of Smotrich, for example, is very clearly a means of extermination for the Palestinians. That is precisely what they are talking about now. This new National Guard, they want to create a settler army, effectively, that is not accountable. And the fact that Smotrich made those statements about the Palestinians not existing behind a map of Greater Israel is indicative of the direction in which Israel is going. They can no longer hide behind the legitimacy and protection of the United States. They can no longer hide behind the concept that they are the only democracy in the Middle East. They are a fascist state. They are a radical state. They are an extremist state, and the rest of the world can see it for what it is. Now, it is an apartheid state.
Taking a look at what you mentioned, this National Guard, I'd like to ask you, Amazin Lamsaya, what this is all about. I mean, first of all, let's put that into context before you give us an explanation, where there was a deal. Now, either the world was taken for a ride regarding what happened in Israel and the protests, where it was put on to, I guess, a pause, and then the deal was made, because this deal that was made, which came out to be a National Guard contract, I guess, of some sorts, where Ben-Gvir will withdraw his opposition, as I mentioned, to the judicial reforms, and Netanyahu will approve the formation of this National Guard under the control of Itamar Ben-Gvir. Tell us exactly what did Ben-Gvir get in exchange for pausing the judicial reforms?
Yes, indeed, Netanyahu, as the Prime Minister of the State of Israel, said the first statement that he released when he formed the government is that this is a government to serve Jewish interests and that only the Jewish people have a right in the State of Israel, and that his government will settle the land, including in the Galilee, the Negev, and what he called Judea and Samaria. This is the agenda of the government that he formulated as a prime minister. Now, this was the consensus of the right-wing fascist movement that he put together, without which he would not get away from being tried for corruption. So he had to do this. He had to compromise with them. From the beginning, he had to compromise with them. And now, of course, to delay, because he had this impossible pressure on him, especially when you have basically shut down by the Histadrut, the Ben-Gurion airport was shut down, you know, hospitals, schools, universities, etc. The country was shut down, basically. And he had to compromise even further. So what does he compromise with? Again, with the blood of the Palestinians, because we, the Palestinians, are expendable. and easy to basically sell us off to Ben Gvir and his fascist militia, which he will now create, militia of the West Bank, that is like a thug army that he controls as Ben Gvir, his own army of thugs, basically, who will be fully armed and have a right to kill as many Palestinians as they can. This is the price of, and there will be further compromises, I assure you, so-called compromises. There will be further subjugation to the right-wing fascists.
Well, there can't be any compromises because, believe it or not, Zaki Ahmad Amayat, we're looking at Ben Gvir to have wanted this deal, and the reason that he gave, and you almost have to, I mean, I almost fell off the chair when I read the reasons for it, which it said he argued for the need of this special force because he was complaining about the lack of responsiveness of the Israeli, of the directives that he gave to the Israeli security forces. So he wants to have that under his belt, under his watch, complete control over it. So if that's the case, what are we looking at? We know what he stands for. He has made it very clear the way he views Palestinians. So it matters are only going to get worse for the Palestinians.
The way it's been painted within the media and the public eye is that this was a compromise by Itamar Ben-Gvir. However, that's not actually the case. If you've been following the reforms, there are multiple reforms. There's the judicial reform, but one of the other big reforms that were taking place was the proposal with regards to the control of the occupied West Bank, which falls under the Israeli military. This was meant to shift now to Itamar Ben-Gvir. And there was a massive pushback by those that are part of this formation called Kogad, which is in charge of the occupied territories. And there's actually an open letter, this is well before this alleged compromise, by certain former Israeli generals, former heads of the Mossad, former heads of Shin Bet. They were the authors of Security First. It was a policy document for the settlement with the Palestinian people, however, still enforcing occupation, but trying to push it in the right direction. And they came forward and they said that by effectively handing over control outside of the military to an individual such as Itamar Ben-Gvir, what you have now is a complete annexation of the Palestinian territory. What this is actually annexation. So you have now an armed force that is not accountable to any structure within the Israeli military. It's not going to be accountable in terms of international law, as I understand it. And this will pose a huge danger. What you have is now militias fighting the settler battles. This is extremely dangerous. However, this is not something I believe that is novel. This was on the table all along. They've just repackaged it and put it as a compromise. It never was. It's always been on the table, and Itamar Ben-Gvir is effectively putting into play what he had proposed. Another point that needs to be considered, and many of the viewers might not know this, is that the Israeli government had been consulting with Poland with regards to the reforms, and they had the same pushback in Poland with regards to certain reforms. 2 years had passed. Their reforms were then retabled, and because the social situation had changed, it went through. So they are trying different tactics and mechanisms to get through their policies. They are not putting their guns away. In fact, they're sticking to their guns, and they're just putting it into different clothing, different packaging, and selling it to the public and to the media outlets.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
All right, so let's take a look at We can go into what Smotrich has said over here, Masih Hamsaya, in terms of the Palestinians, which I'm sure you're well aware of it, how Israel should wipe out the Palestinian town of Huwara, which we mentioned. I'm looking down some of the other things he has said. There is no such thing as Palestinians because there is no such thing as the Palestinian people, which was met with cheers and applaud from a gathering that was done with the Times of Israel. So here you have the makeup of what, there's no surprise there. Of course, maybe the extreme points of views is a surprise. But there are many people who are not liking what's happening. One of them is the UAE, who signed on to the so-called Abraham Accords with Israel and is said that they are now on the UAE is on a collision course. Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed came out promising a few million dollars for Huwara to be rebuilt after that big incident there. What are we looking at when it comes to the way that the Arab countries are now viewing this, especially the ones who signed on with Israel? Are they feeling regret, do you think?
Well, they are squirming. They don't know how to deal with this in their usual public relations campaigns. But they don't understand how to proceed, especially in light of the declining power of the United States, which I had relied on for so many years, decades, in fact, to keep them in power. This declining U.S. empire is a big problem for them. But some countries like Indonesia are putting them to shame when you have Indonesia forfeiting even FIFA, Football Association, basically international football games in Indonesia, because Indonesia refused participation of Israeli athletes, while Israel, of course, is rummaging through the United Arab Emirates, taking its wealth basically to deposit in Israeli banks and forcing the United Arab Emirates to basically invest even in Israeli military industries. This is becoming more and more exposed, and the Arab states have normalized with Israel. I don't say they are coming to regret it, but they are squirming in difficulty. They are finding it very, very difficult to manage the public relations aspect of it. And I think eventually they will fall apart because, as I said, the head of the snake, the United States, is falling apart and as a superpower. The latest survey showed that the support for even for Russian invasion of Ukraine has increased from 24 countries to 36 countries that support Russia now. So the U.S. is feeling the pressure. China and Russia are feeling more relief and more support globally. So I think the Zionists are feeling even more pressure. And perhaps this explains why there was this viciousness between the two camps of Zionism, because when you have pressure, you tend to try to assign blame to others.
Looking at
instead of thinking of the ideology of Zionism as the problem.
Yeah, well, you know what? I'm glad you raised that, because there was a new Gallup poll that I'd like to ask you about, Zakir Ahmad Mayed, where it indicated that Democrats actually now sympathize more with Palestinians. And based on what it said, that after a decade which Democrats showed increasing affinity toward the Palestinians, the figures are that their sympathies now lie more with the Palestinians than the Israelis, 49% versus 38%. You even have Democratic lawmakers who are against Israel in terms of what it's doing. What do you think that shows? I mean, if you have the lawmakers, well, Democrats in this case, who are viewing it this way against the Israelis and for the Palestinians, and you have the U.S. president who has issued that warning, in a sense, if you want to call it that, to the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, do you think that that would be enough for Israel to change its behavior, at least a little bit, maybe?
I don't believe that they have sufficient power to shift the Israeli position. I think my fellow panelist has depicted it correctly, the fight within Zionism today. And this is not about the future of Israel or Israel's relations with the United States or the rest of the world. This is everything to do with Netanyahu trying to prevent himself from ending up in jail. This is why he's making the compromises that he's making, or alleged compromises. He's changing the very nature of the Israeli state to complete and open apartheid state, and disposing of the veneer of alleged legitimacy that they had been hiding behind and protecting their military brass with. What we are seeing today and the change within the global dynamic is the very similar change to what we saw with the attitudes towards the apartheid state of South Africa. The global community had turned a blind eye to the oppression of the African people and black people of South Africa. However, when it became a liability, we started seeing the change. We saw the same change reflected in organizations such as Human Rights Watch, Beth Salem, and Amnesty International. We must understand that many liberal Zionists actually fund these organizations, and there has been a change. This has been noted by Professor Norman Finkelstein. So the global viewpoint has shifted. It's therefore not a surprise when you see these statistics indicating that the Democrats have now softened their views towards the Palestinians. It becomes incredibly clear that the apartheid state has no place within this world. It is being exposed for what it truly is. It is a radical state that is completely off the cliff, and there is no tolerance for this type of conduct, and therefore you see extreme violence, as you saw towards the demise of the apartheid state here in South Africa. There was an increase in violence directed against black South Africans. You're seeing exactly the same thing with the Palestinians. These are the last kicks of a dying horse, in my opinion.
All right. We need to wrap this up, since this is the last question that I can ask Mazen Qumsaya. This pause is going to turn into it coming back into the fore in terms of the fact that Netanyahu needs to deal with it. So does Itamar Ben-Gvir and his cabinet regarding the judicial reforms. It is called a pause if they were to continue to go down that path with which the U.S. president said that it shouldn't. What are we looking at with Israel? Are we looking at the Israel unraveling within itself, and the worst case that this may entail? Less than a minute, please.
Yes, very quickly. I think Netanyahu's era is ending. He's the longest running prime minister who I've served, and I think he's ending. I don't think Zionism is ending yet. Zionism will continue. The rift with the United States will grow, because as the U.S. empire declines, they will also think of why they declined, and that a lot has to do with the Zionist lobby in Washington, and this will become more and more obvious. So I think we are seeing a geopolitical transformation, and I look forward to an end of an era and a beginning of a new era of global collaboration and cooperation, and where a multipolar world rather than a unipolar world.
Thank you very much, Mazen Qumsaya, Palestinian scientist and author from Bethlehem. Zakir Ahmed Maya.